by 2026. It is hence why the U.S. were keen to see Morales go, as the U.S. only have a trade value with Bolivia to the figure of around $1 billion, with goods exported to Bolivia valued at $562 million, whilst imports, including lithium, are at $486 million.
The arrival of the coronavirus in Bolivia immediately took its toll on the recent elections held in the nation, with the original election date set to last May. However, in order to stem the rising number of cases, it was decided by the electoral bodies to postpone the election for the sake of keeping the virus in check. Yet much like the rest of South America, Bolivia is no exception when it comes to the virus, as at the time of writing, the country has seen a total of 141,000 confirmed cases of infection, with around 8,700 deaths, which compared to other nations, is still relatively low in numbers. Much like everywhere else in the world, the country has had to introduce some forms of lockdown in the bigger cities, which of course has led to store closures, offices winding down, and many other commercial and economic premises taking a hit, which for a small nation like Bolivia can have a devastating impact on their economy. With the nation receiving several loans to help it emerge from the pandemic, for example, a $254 million loan from the World Bank, how then is the Bolivian economy coping with the virus and other loans being granted to them, a benefit or a hindrance?
Bolivia has been affected by coronavirus, and it's not clear that how exact the data is coming out about that. It certainly underscores the need for a well-funded, accessible health service, which is an absolute priority to build up. And it's entirely appropriate that political leaders turn their attention to that. But with regards to the loans, that's a more worldwide question, I think. I think the IMF are strongly encouraging countries to take out loans, which is an interesting turn of events in itself.
For Bolivia, tourism is also a major source of income. However, the arrival of the virus has also taken its tolls on this sector, with the pandemic believed to be responsible for around $890 million of losses for the Bolivian Tourist Board, with around $530 million of that coming from domestic tourism and $360 million coming from inbound tourism. For the many indigenous people of Bolivia, the arrival of the COVID-19 virus is of particular importance, especially for the more isolated or rural communities who are already less exposed to viruses than others and have little or no access to healthcare facilities. For some people in the country, they've turned to traditional forms of medicine to help them through. However, as the global results have shown when it comes to dealing with the virus, the consequences of corona have been devastating, with over 1 million dead worldwide. The struggle continues for both Bolivia and the rest of the world.
Joining me in the studio today is Diego Sanchez Ancochea, a professor of political economy development from the University of Oxford. He specializes in the development and economies of Latin American nations and has work published in various journals, including World Development and the Journal of Latin American Studies, as well as having co-edited numerous books. His current work focuses on explaining why some Latin American countries are more unequal than others. Professor, many thanks for joining our show today.
Thank you so much for the opportunity and for the invitation. It's great to be here.
Well, my first question is about Bolivia itself. We have seen that the finance minister, Luis Arce, has won a landslide victory in the election and has immediately promised to help the economy of the country grow. Now, my question is, what kind of challenges is he going to face in delivering on his promises?
So I think we should remember that Bolivia has faced, like the rest of Latin America, the combination of a health crisis, an economic crisis, and in the Bolivian case, a political crisis as well in the last few months. So I think there will be two big challenges. The first is, how do they get the money from their public accounts to fund projects that are very much needed? And the other is, how do you regain political stability and sometimes of collaboration between different groups on society that have been split in recent years?
Oh, thank you. Now, your current work focuses on how Latin American nations, some of them, are more unequal than others. And my question is, how is Bolivia able to establish itself as a serious economic player in the region and beyond?
It's a great question. So Bolivia historically has been one of the most unequal countries, particularly between the indigenous population and the small white elite. But during the Morales administration in the last decade and decade and a half, actually things improved a lot. So Latin America Bolivia reduced inequality more than any other Latin American country. Of course, the big question is whether with a new president we can start back trying to reduce inequality and promote development or not, and we'll have to see in the next few months and years.
Finally, like many nations in Latin America, indigenous people play a huge part in the economics and politics of the country. How have indigenous people in Bolivia contributed to the economy of the country? And is this unwavering support for Morales and Arce a good sign for the future of the country and maybe other Latin American nations?
So another great question. So Morales' project was very much about trying to incorporate indigenous peoples and increase their political rights. And as a result, actually a new middle class of indigenous peoples emerged, and indigenous peoples as a political force also present in the government also appeared, and it was important. The last few months, the government that replaced Morales tried to actually reverse some of these gains, but I am very hopeful that Arce will start or enhance the power of indigenous peoples, and we might actually see a new renewal of a Latin America that has more success at reducing inequalities and bringing indigenous rights to the forefront.
Professor Diego Sanchez Ancochea from the University of Oxford, many thanks for being on the show today. It was lovely hearing your thoughts on this topic.
Great talking to you, and I look forward to future occasions.
All right. Make sure you check out Professor Sanchez Ancochea's upcoming book, which is titled The Cost of Inequality in Latin America, published by I.B. Torres, and available for pre-order now from the usual outlets. Bolivia, as we know, is the world's largest producer of lithium. Let's now take a look at how lithium is playing a part in one of the world's most lucrative emerging markets in our next report.
Bolivia is said to hold around 25% of the world's total lithium resources, with some estimates placing it as high as 70%. Along with Chile and Argentina, Bolivia make up the so-called lithium triangle, with the metal being concentrated in various salt plains around South America, covering the Atacama Desert and its neighboring areas. Some have called the exploration and mining of the metal as the White Gold Rush, with a total value on the market of an estimated $5.9 billion across the world, with the potential of the market rising in the near future, in part sparked by one certain industry. With the world paying more attention to the carbon footprint issue, many of the world's leading car makers are now turning their attention to the electric car market, which, as we all know, relies heavily on batteries inside the vehicles, which, of course, are mainly fueled by lithium. Sales of electric cars topped 2.1 million units in 2019, with total electric car sales accounting for 2.6% of the global market. However, zero-emission vehicles are set to rise dramatically over the next decade, with diesel vehicle production for one seeing an eventual phase-out, followed by likely, one day, petrol. One of the biggest emerging markets in the electrical vehicle production line is China, who are already home to the largest number of electrical vehicle charging points in the world, suggesting that the Chinese will no doubt be eyeing the rest of the world for them to place their electrical vehicles, hence competing with some very big players. So will Bolivia's vast resources of lithium come to the rescue of the Bolivian economy, in particular when it comes to assisting in the production of batteries for electric vehicles?
It's a bit complicated. Bolivia forms part of what's called the Lithium Triangle with Argentina and Chile. And frankly, both Argentina, but particularly Chile, have moved faster than Bolivia had in terms of developing those resources. Bolivia has one quarter of the known resources of in the world of lithium. The problem is it's found at a higher altitude than in Chile and Argentina, and technically it is more complicated to produce lithium hydroxide or lithium carbonate, which is the key compound which is used for batteries.
But should Bolivia instead be wary and consider the notion of killing two birds with one stone? When Evo Morales was in power, he suggested that Bolivia should not only produce the lithium to sell abroad to make batteries, but also consider the idea of building the batteries themselves, hence adding another layer to the economy and leaving something for Arce to consider in his upcoming term and promise of rebuilding the economy.
I'm pleased to welcome back into the studio our regular current affairs and impact analyst, Mohan Albedin. Mohan, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
So people in Bolivia have made a very bold political statement by electing Arce, the former finance minister. But what are the economic impacts of this election on the country?
Well, yeah, that's absolutely. So it was a surprise electoral victory a week or so ago. So the socialists are back. Now, we have the tweet here, victory against U.S. imperialism. Well, yes, but then the really serious issues about rebuilding partnerships with China and just generally going back to the, you know, the Evo Morales philosophy of building the country from bottom up. And, of course, in Bolivia, the story isn't just political. It's social. It's kind of ethnic because Morales, if you like, he represented or he purported to represent the indigenous people. Who have historically been dispossessed and impoverished in Bolivia. So this is a really big story. And I think the victors in this election have got their work cut out, to be honest, in terms of putting the economy on a stable footing.
So yeah. Next.
So, yeah, so Luis Arce's most pressing challenge, economy, obviously, like everywhere else, is a huge concern for the Bolivians, more so than COVID-19. So again, this just speaks to the big challenges ahead, really. Let's not forget, this is an impoverished country. Even by Latin American standards, it's very poor. But I would add to that the foreign policy challenge, or at least the regional challenge, because Bolivia now is in a kind of a hostile environment. You have Brazil that has this kind of looks to Trump. Mm-hmm. So by extension, they're an enemy of Bolivia. You have Colombia, which is very belligerent, led by a right-wing regime. Their only ally, really, is Venezuela, and they have problems of their own. So, third and final tweet you have. So, it's had good growth, big reductions in poverty. It's a mixed picture, really. So, I mean, under Morales, they followed this Venezuelan policy of helping the indigenous people. The only problem with that is if you focus on one group, so by extension, by definition, you're going to impoverish or at least disadvantage another group. I think what this new Bolivian regime needs above all is to show national unity, to demonstrate it can look after the economic well-being of all the Bolivian people. Right. And I think that is the route to success for them. Because I mean, if you read from this tweet, and this is very accurate, actually, it captures all their problems in a very pithy tweet. But So really, they need a holistic approach.
To wrap it up, I can say we are hopeful, but it's not going to be easy.
This was a very pleasant victory, I think. I think it puts aside all the difficulties from last year, because last year there was an ugly coup in Bolivia. There was a lot of violence. A lot of people were hurt. This, at least, is an opportunity to correct those wrongs. Mm-hmm. And as long as they can get the best policy, the good policies in place, they have a good future, I think.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today as well. That was Mohan Albedin, our regular current affairs and impact analyst. Now, in our final report today, we take a look at how Bolivia compares to and interacts with its neighboring countries in Latin America. So stay right where you are.
South America, as we recently discovered in our recent program right here on Economic Divide, where we covered the Inter-American Development Bank, is a highly complex continent, especially when one studies it on an economic level. On the one hand, you have a country such as Brazil, a nation that sits comfortably in the top 10 of the world's largest GDPs, with over $2.05 trillion per year income, and hence making it a key emerging power. On the other hand, you have a country like Argentina, a nation which is on the verge of a second financial crisis and is about to see its currency plummet in value. Across South America, there's also a whole host of layers in between. For Bolivia, relations with its neighbours is highly important, in particular as Bolivia is a landlocked country and access to ports are limited. It's hence why Bolivia and Chile, for example, have clashed in the past when it comes to this particular benefit. So how are Bolivian relations with their neighbours now?
That region, like you've mentioned, Brazil, Argentina, Chile, Chile as well, they're also the big players in that region. Bolivia gets compared more often to Peru. One of the key challenges for Bolivia is really to turn its economy away from reliance on natural resources, so diversifying the economy in general, which could include some exploitation of natural resources, but diversifying it so it's not so much for reliance is key
But it's not just nation states that Bolivia interact with the nation also playing a role in liaising with international institutions, which also see relations appearing to look promising for Bolivia.
Internationally, with the International Monetary Fund, relations I think are probably going to be not as bad as people might think. IMF has recently been going through a kind of mea culpa, and this noticeable shift in its approach to poverty reduction and income distribution and taxation of international wealth. So I think ARCE in some ways fits the mold there with this new thinking in the IMF.
However, like many other nations in South America, it's the interaction with the US that ultimately many want to address. The arrival of Evo Morales certainly soured ties between the two, with the unionist Morales proving popular with farmers and locals in Bolivia as he sought to eradicate US policy in the country, going as far to say that wherever there's a US ambassador, there's a coup. How right he was. As mentioned earlier in the show, with the arrival of Arce at the helm and Pompeo sending his wishes, will the US's warm approach to Bolivia be nothing more than a wolf in sheep's clothing?
For many countries in South America, the resistance to U.S. imperialism is a fact of everyday life, with Venezuela and Bolivia being prime examples of such policy. It is hence why the comeback of an indigenous party in Bolivia is being hailed as a miracle by some, with the working class front lines clearly defending the people of the country. With the U.S. having been involved in so many regime changes around the world, the onus is now on Bolivia and President-elect Luis Arce to show that the nation can, in fact, stand on its own two feet, embrace its natural resources, and most importantly, set an example to other nations in the region and beyond as to how to stand up to imperialist capitalism. What now remains to be seen is whether other nations in the region will follow this example and see foreign interference in regional affairs become a thing of the past. That's all about the time we have for this episode. On behalf of myself, Omid Roshandel, and the whole team here on Economic Divide, stay safe. We'll see you again next time.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
Assalamu alaikum. Welcome.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, other life forms.
What are we talking about today, sister?
Today on Youth Station, we're talking about nothing matters.
Nothing does matter. Who cares? Who cares? It doesn't matter.
Hey, I think we're done here. All right, bye. Let's go home. Bye. When does that attitude develop in life?
What are we talking about this in a bad way or a good way, first of all? Because a nothing matters attitude can be a good thing, right?
That's a very good perspective to have on it.
So what's the good way and what's the bad way?
I think the good way of having a nothing matters attitude is the way Amir al-Mu'mineen had it.
Mm-hmm.
When he was offered the leadership of the Muslim Ummah, the Muslim nation, he said to them what?
This Khilafah, to me, he was actually stitching up his shoe at that point, wasn't he? He was stitching up his sandals, and he said, what is the worth of this sandal? And his companion replied that its worth is like not even a dirham or two, like not even one gold piece, you know, it's nothing. He said, this Khilafah is less worthy in my eyes than this sandal.
Exactly.
That is one of the most inspirational kind of stories that we take from Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Or when he says that this world in my eyes is like the bone of a pig in the hands of a leper.
Yeah, that's nasty. I've heard another one that, yeah, Imam Ali alayhi salam, he said, this dunya is as lowly as the snot of a goat. I like your one better. Let's analyze this for a moment, right?
Yes, let's.
The bone of a pig is just like, it's a nasty something.
Exactly. Like, the pig is nasty, and imagine its bone.
Yeah.
Totally useless and nasty.
Yes.
in the hands of a leper. But I mean, I'm not saying leper people are nasty, but it's such a contagious disease,
yes,
that people try to stay away from anyone who suffers from it because they don't want to get it. It's very painful.
But people will reach over to try to snatch this bone of a pig.
Exactly.
From the leper's hand,
yeah,
and then they will get the disease. Wow,
that's
I never
so
thought about it that way.
Yeah, and I've never
you
analyzed
did it.
That, that
you did
one,
it. It was you, sister.
And but the way you looked at it, and yeah, you know, when we have that nothing matters attitude, the way Amir al-Mu'mineen has, because he has understood the insignificant worth of this world, and he knows that what matters is the hereafter, and that's what we've been created for. That is our final destination and objective, and anything that we do in this world, if it's supposed to harm our hereafter or not benefit our hereafter, then it means jack.
It does mean jack.
Right?
Or
so I think that
jackal.
So I think that sort of nothing matters attitude is the good sort. What's the bad sort?
The bad sort is you don't care whether it good happens or bad happens. You don't care about your destiny, whether you're going to hell or heaven. Would that be the
yes,
negative one? Because then you're just like, oh, I don't care. This old lady is falling over. Nobody's there to help her across the road. I don't care. You know,
yeah, yeah.
Bad things are happening. I don't care. You know, the world is turning into a mess. I don't care.
Where do you think that sort of I don't care stems from? That level of indifference?
I was going to ask you. I need to think about it.
I think it comes from despair and loss of hope.
Uh-huh.
You know, because when in Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam's case, he was like, nothing matters because compared to the hereafter, the world doesn't matter,
right?
But still, the same Amir al-Mu'mineen was the greatest advocate of justice.
Mm-hmm.
He fought for the rights of the widows and the orphans and the oppressed.
Yes, yes.
He was this, you know, justice personified. There's even actually a book by this name, Ali, The Voice of Justice, by Jordak. Anyway, he was a Christian author, by the way.
I mean, Imam Ali alayhi salam was a lion by day, and he was an ascetic by night.
There we go. And that's a huge deal. And
you've reminded me of a verse, actually, referring to the negative kind of thing. Because if you're putting it down to despair,
mm-hmm,
there's a verse, right? It says,
those are the ones who have despaired or lost hope in the mercy of their Lord.
If you exactly. So if you see these people, I mean, it happens to youths often, don't we? Because this is Youth Station. It happens to youths often, right? Where they go through this phase where they just don't care. Have you seen the goth culture in America?
Yep.
It exists in other places as well, right? Where they just kind of wear black clothes and black lipstick and black makeup, and then
yeah,
they just go around, you know, life is bad.
And dull, man, meaningless.
It's dark. Yeah. Nothing means anything. And you're just like, kid, man, grow up. Some things do mean something, don't they?
It depends, I think, on the sort of meaning you're trying to find from it.
Mm.
At the end of the world, you're really not going to find any meaning in this world because it's not meant to last. You know, and whatever has meaning in this world is that which can help with your hereafter. Really simple words. If it doesn't mean anything, if I have all the wealth, all the money, all the success in the world, after 65 years, I'm going to die, and I'm going to leave it for people to inherit or not inherit, and I'm going to rot in hell for all of eternity.
Right. What are the things that do have meaning? We're talking about like love.
There's a
mercy,
hadith. Yeah. That which helps
justice,
you
truth,
build your hereafter.
Uh-huh, right.
Anything that influences your hereafter in a positive way,
mm-hmm,
from this world is meaningful.
So this is a hadith. Since you mentioned that, there's this beautiful hadith, which I used to overlook when I was younger. I used to think, nah, it's just something you tell kids. But no, this is actually one of the hadith that Imam Khomeini quotes. The Holy Prophet, when he goes to Mi'raj, he sees angels, and those angels are building things,
mm,
right? They're building these unimaginably beautiful, splendorous buildings, right?
Okay.
And they keep on building them, and then they're stopping.
Yeah.
And then they're starting again, and then they're stopping. And then they're starting again. So the Holy Prophet asks, why do they keep stopping, and when do they start? Well, what's going on here? The angel Jibril replies that, look, the materials that they're using to build these buildings with is actually supplied to them by the good deeds, by the dhikr of the servants. Whenever they're doing dhikr in this world, they're getting those materials in the next world, and they're actually building those things. Whenever they stop doing the dhikr of Allah, whenever they forget Allah, it ceases building it.
Exactly.
So we have to understand that we are every step of the way building our hereafter. We're either building a hell or we're building a heaven, or we're actually just not building anything. We're just sitting
wasting
idle.
Our time.
Yeah, we're wasting our time.
And that's when nothing matters. That's like
okay, yeah. And if your life's attitude is the negative type of nothing matters, then yeah, that's what you're doing. You are nothing does matter, and your hereafter won't matter either because you have actually no care. One of the things that Imam Khomeini says, which is absolutely beautiful, is you need to, so for example, when you're praying, right? You need to be aware and realize how much you're being rewarded. A person who's standing in front of Allah, right? You're standing in front of Allah, but you don't even feel that Allah is rewarding you for it. How are you going to enjoy that worship?
Yes, yes, yes. And that comes, from the deep-rooted hope we have to have in Allah, subhanahu wa ta'ala. I feel that often people reach that attitude of nothing matters and absolute despair and hopelessness because they feel like their actions are insignificant, the world is going sideways, nothing is getting better, no matter how hard I try, I'm not going to fix the situation. But we fail or we forget that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala doesn't necessarily reward you based on the outcome. He rewards you on your effort. He rewards you on your intention. So the smallest effort and the smallest intention you put into bettering yourself, bettering the world, and bettering your hereafter is a big deal in the eyes of Allah, right? So when you were talking about that old lady slipping and falling and that indifferent youth being like, so what? People are dying all across the world. Why should I take time out of my day to help this random old lady?
Yeah. Right? Why don't you just walk over and stomp
exactly,
on her feet or something?
Exactly, and put her out of her misery. Why are we so good at this scenario?
I think we have a dark sense of humor.
We do have a dark sense of humor, anyway. But if we come to this understanding, if we accept the fact that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala مِثْقَالَ ذَرَّةٍ خَيْرًا يَرَى وَمِثْقَالَ ذَرَّةٍ شَرًّا يَرَى, the smallest speck of good deed and the smallest speck of bad deed, Allah sees it, Allah acknowledges it, Allah rewards it, Allah punishes it, punishes for it, then we won't reach that level of despair and hopelessness.
Yes.
Because everything is noticed by Allah.
Do you know these two verses?
Okay.
A person came to the Holy Prophet. He knew nothing of Islam.
Yep.
He came to the Holy Prophet. The Holy Prophet taught him these two verses. That's it. And he said, that's all I want to know. And is this really true? And he said, yes, this is true. And he left. The Holy Prophet said, Ja'a faqih. He left a faqih. He's understood the depths of this religion just because of those two verses.
Yeah.
If we understood that, like, an atom's weight of good, Allah sees it. Even a tiny, slightest bit of evil, Allah sees it.
Just the thought of it makes my heart swell with joy and hope.
Mm.
Like, I'm just going to go and...
Suddenly everything does matter.
And that's beautiful. A little stressful, but beautiful, you know? Sometimes I feel like the youth turn to the attitude of nothing matters because they're over-pressurized by the society and their family, even by their religious family. You know, basically, feel like no matter how hard I try, I'm still not good enough. So,
I was recently talking to a sister, and she went through depression, a stage of severe, deep depression.
Good God!
And she said that it's because of her mother.
Huh?
Yeah.
Why? Did she pass?
Her mother was a Muslim and everything, but the version of Islam that she was giving to her was really, really depressing.
Oh,
and
no.
You know, she was, just recite this dua. If you don't recite this dua, and without understanding it, just recite it Arabic, however you can. And if you don't, then you're going to go to hell. This really, really negative outlook on the a'mal. There's a negative way to look at things, right? You know, if you don't do this thing, you are going to hell. I'm not talking about wajibat here. I'm talking about those things which...
Recommended.
Those recommended mustahab acts which should be, you know, a joy and a pleasure to actually go towards. Mm. But instead you turn it into this, you know...
chore.
Yeah, a chore. Ah, that's the word, sister. You hit the nail on the head. That's what it's about. You turn the religion into a chore, obviously you're going to feel depressed. That's meant to be your purpose in life, but you've just turned it into something arduous and boring and painstaking. Exactly. Islam isn't like that. Even when it's telling you to do jihad, we learn this from one of the great shuhada. He says that, look, striving, fighting in the way of Allah, it doesn't make you tired at all. If you're getting tired in what you do, you should know that you're doing something wrong. Yeah, they turn into everything into a competition, right?
Exactly.
A dunyawi kind of competition.
And they constantly raise the bar. Like, I've seen this happen, which is really weird. You'd see a renowned family, a good religious family, and their children, like, reach this attitude of nothing matters. And you wonder to yourself, how did that even happen? Have you seen their parents?
Yeah.
And I think it's because though the parents' heart are the right place and they are coming from the right place and they have good intentions and they want to secure their children's hereafter and sometimes maybe secure their family name along the way, but they pressurize the child so much that, oh, our family, you know, is so-and-so and it's really important for you to be a so-and-so person, be a scholar and go study and achieve these Islamic statuses and success because otherwise
so-and-so's son is giving speeches. You need to give speeches.
Need to
this
give
is
speech.
Actually what you just said, this sister who I was talking to, she said exactly that.
Oh, no.
Exactly that. Other people in the community, they were getting their children to do speeches. Why aren't you doing it? You know?
So, exactly. And that leads the child to feel like, you know what? No matter what I do, I'm not going to win. I'm not going to do anything right by your eyes. You so know, just...
There's a purity.
They give up.
There's a purity in the hearts of the youth, right? They, when they want to do something, inshallah, you know, sometimes they really do want to do it for the right reasons. It takes a while to, you know, purify those intentions. But sometimes their parents have dirtier intentions, right? They feel like they're doing it for the deen, but they're not. They're actually doing it to show other people that, you know, my son or my daughter is doing this. And it all becomes a dunyawi. And by the way, this isn't just... It's not just the religion which is used in this way. It's just dunya...
Exactly. I mean, you could have been a doctor. Why aren't you a doctor yet?
Doctor.
When are you going to be a doctor? Either be a doctor or be a doctor.
Yeah.
If you're going to be a doctor, I'm going to disown you.
Well, then the kid starts to feel like, well, if I don't become a doctor, there's no point in my existence.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, they measure the worth of a child with the success that the child achieves and attains in life when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala created that child for a whole other purpose.
There's two things we have to say here, right? Imam Ali alayhi salam, the beautiful hadith, he says that, look, do not raise your children in the same way that you were raised, but they were born for a different purpose.
Yep.
And the second thing is that, look, if you want to figure out whether what you're doing is for the right reasons or not, think about this. If you were living in a communist society where everybody gets paid exactly the same wage, would you still want to be a doctor? Huh?
That's all the time we have for today's Youth Station. The one single salient takeaway we can have of this discussion is do not lose despair. For وَمَنْ يَعْمَلْ مِثْقَالَ ذَرَّةٍ خَيْرًا يَرَهُ وَمَنْ يَعْمَلْ مِثْقَالَ ذَرَّةٍ شَرًّا يَرَهُ.
Do not lose hope.
Yes, what did I say?
Do not lose despair.
Do not despair and lose hope. Because the smallest good things we do, Allah sees, and the smallest bad things we do, Allah sees.
And sometimes it's the smallest things that matter most.
Exactly. Nothing that we do goes unnoticed by the eyes of Allah. So never lose hope. Thank you for being with us.
Wassalamu
alaikum
wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
My love, my life, my days, my nights, my wealth, my prayers are for you. Now I know how it's like to have your precious love in my life. Now I know how it feels to finally be at peace inside. I wish that everybody how amazing it feels to love you. I wish that everyone could see how your love has set me free. Set me free and made me strong.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
On top of the surge in COVID cases across the United States of America, coronavirus hospitalizations are also soaring in more than a dozen states, according to data compiled by the COVID Tracking Project. The latest record-shattering coronavirus figures came days after Deborah Birx, coordinator of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, warned in an internal report dated November 2nd that the United States is entering the most concerning and most deadly phase of this pandemic and urged the Trump administration to take much more aggressive action. Cases are rapidly rising in nearly 30% of all USA counties, the highest number of county hotspots we have seen with this pandemic, reads Burke's report, which was obtained by the Post. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jake Johnson Ryder. This article is published under the heading, This is a Tsunami. Pay attention. Experts horrified as COVID-19 hits new record in the United States of America. Here's the details of this article. With much of the United States' attention understandably consumed by developments in the high-stakes presidential election, the nation on Wednesday, November 4th, reported a daily record of more than 104,000 new COVID-19 infections, the latest alarming indication that far from U.S. President Donald Trump's repeated insistence that the virus is fading away, the deadly pandemic is only getting worse as the winter months approach. Count that worries me? Over 100,000 COVID-19 cases yesterday. Yale epidemiologist Greg Gonzalez tweeted on Thursday morning, November 5th. Death up 21%. There has been silence on this from the White House and the Dems. This is a tsunami washing over Americans. Pay attention, he added. Coming just 24 hours after millions of Americans showed up at polling places across the U.S. to cast their ballots in the presidential race and down ballot contest on Wednesday, November 4th, marked the first time the U.S. recorded at least 100,000 new coronavirus infections just in a single day. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, has been warning since June, when the U.S. was reporting around 40,000 cases daily, that the U.S. could reach 100,000 new infections per day if more aggressive preventive measures were not taken by the federal government in partnership with the state and local leaders. We are in for a whole lot of hurt. It's not a good situation, Fauci told the Washington Post recently. All the stars are aligned in the wrong place as you go into the fall and winter season, with people congregating at home indoors. You could not possibly be positioned more poorly, he added. On top of the surge in COVID cases across the U.S., coronavirus hospitalizations are also soaring in more than a dozen states, according to data compiled by the COVID Tracking Project. The latest record-shattering coronavirus figures came days after Deborah Birx, coordinator of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, warned in an internal report dated November 2nd that the U.S. is entering the most concerning and most deadly phase of this pandemic, and urged the Trump administration to take much more aggressive action. Cases are rapidly rising in nearly 30% of all USA counties, the highest number of county hotspots we have seen with this pandemic, reads Birx's report, which was obtained by the Post. Half of the United States is in the red or orange zone for cases despite flat or declining testing, she added. As Birx sounded the alarm behind the scenes and other experts issued similar warnings publicly, Trump continued to hold crowded in-person rallies in the days leading up to Tuesday, November 3rd election and downplayed the severity of the pandemic, which has killed more than 234,000 people in the United States alone. As Common Dreams reported over the weekend, the Stanford University analysis linked 18 of Trump's campaign rallies from June 20 to September 30 to more than 30,000 coronavirus infections and at least 700 deaths. That's all I hear about now. Turn on television, COVID, 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 COVID. A plane goes down, 500 people dead, they don't talk about it. COVID, 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 Trump told a crowd of his supporters in North Carolina late last month. By the way, on November 4th, you won't hear about it anymore. Dr. Peter Hoetz, a professor at Baylor College of Medicine, tweeted recently that he has long worried the United States would reach 100,000 COVID cases in a single day. A grim milestone, he said, further lays bare the Trump administration's failure. I dreaded this day. Here it is. And the lights are off for the entire executive branch of the federal government in the U.S., Hoetz said. Historic and unprecedented abandonment of the American people. I'm horrified, he added. Thought.
One of the parents came up to our program called Rising Souls. It's a mentorship program we built for middle schoolers. And she brought her son and she said, "Brother, I want to sign my son up." I looked at the young man like he was sitting uncomfortable. He was being a little bit disrespectful. So I told him to step out of my office for a second. Let me talk to your mom. I asked the sister, "Where is your husband?" "The brother, he's busy working." And I said, "Sister, I want you to go back. Tell him that he needs to spend time with his son every week, 1 hour, because that's what the program is about. He needs a role model. He needs to have this man who can show him around, who can guide him. That's what he needs." 2 years later, this mother called me. Said, "Brother, my son physically hit my husband, my beloved parents, companions. We are in the emergency room. Our soul in our community, we are pumping our soul to rescue it because of what is going on in our society. Now, we talked about all the high-level discussions, what the youth are going through. Not a single week passed by in our youth department that we haven't had any issues that was brought up, from sex, drug addicts, alcohol, anything that you can think about. And I think we can all attest to this, that it's the reality of our community. One of the things that we want to take on as Mass National Youth is we want to be able to provide youth workers who can understand, who can play the mentorship role for these young people, for these young brothers and sisters in our community. Unfortunately, the reality is that we have not invested enough in human resources in our massages and our institutions. You don't see well-off youth directors. You don't see individuals who can actually talk to these young people in the massages. One of the things I want to remind you and remind myself, Prophet alayhi salatu salam, he gave time to his community, understood the context. He knew his folks. He hung out with people. He understood the youth issues. And we're struggling because we're building our masajids, yet they're empty of young people. And that is the sad reality of our community. Now, I don't want to be all negative in here. This is the reality. This is the situation we're dealing with. Brothers and sisters, one of the things we do with Mass Youth, we have 36 chapters across the state. We have 17 different youth departments in different states. We are training our youth workers. And the biggest lack in our community right now is the youth workers. I have every massager calling me, asking me, do you have a youth developer? Do you have a youth director who can work with us? Do you have someone who can work in our massager as a youth director? And I cannot find enough people to do that. Or we're lacking those workers. So one of the things that we want to do as a Mass National Youth is develop those youth workers, not just develop them and help them understand how to run nonprofit work, but also help them become a good mentor. Because this is the reality when we're dealing with youth. Listening to them. As parents, and myself as a parent, I'm scared. I'm reading books to understand how to become a better father. Because we have not, you know, one of the things, if you look at how often in the khutbah you heard about mothers, you see this emphasized that we put in our society, in our community about mothers, mothers, but we hardly talk about the responsibility the fathers are not taking. We have young men in the community, we have boys in our community, but we don't have men in our community. And the reality is sad because the fathers are not stepping up, and I'm holding myself accountable as a father. And wallahi, it is sad. And the issue begins at home. You can't just throw your children on Sunday school, or you can't just expect that youth director to baptize your child. We don't have a special Zamzam water for your children. I'm sorry. We need to work together. To raise a child, it takes a community. When I say community, you as a parent do your part. We as a youth directors are going to do our part. The imam has to do their part. The school has to be involved. You as a parent have to be involved in their schools. This is how we can come from different angle, because the arrows that we all face in our society right now. Look at what's going on, from TikTok to Instagram to social pressure. All of these arrows are coming at us, coming to our youth, and they're being damaged. And there's not enough blocking we're doing. There's not enough programs or contents we're developing for them. So one of our, again, responsibility as Mass National Youth is we want to establish, we're in the business of investing in people. I'm not interested in physical buildings. I'm not interested in your masjid project. May Allah bless you. Definitely expand the masjid, no problem. But when that masjid is empty 10 to 12 hours of the entire day, and there's no youth programming, there's no youth directors, some of the institutions, when I look at their budget, is $1 million budget, but I don't have, and they don't want to pay the youth director $60,000 salary. That's not acceptable. And that is not something we should accept as a community. We need to hold our leaders accountable. Why should a young person leave his career making $75,000 in IT field or engineering and come to the masjid for $10 an hour? We need to invest in people that are going to invest in our kids. And this is the reason why Mass National has taken the initiative of investing in people in regards to developing youth directors. Alhamdulillah, we have been doing this for a while. Every year in our annual youth meeting, mashallah, we train over 100 youth workers. In regards to that, we're expanding in 2020. I want to work with you. I don't want to be in this stage talking to you. I want to hear from you. I want to hear your challenges. I want to know the resources that you have in your community. Let's connect together. Let's really be on the ground and let's combine our efforts and invest in people. I want to get 25 to 50 massages to join our training program for the youth directors next year. So that way we can combine the efforts and really help establish those young people and give them right training and build a career for them. Help them into the nonprofit world so they can really take initiative and make this as a career. And of course, we don't want them to be a youth director for the rest of their life. We're going to help them to make sure they're able to go into executive director or leadership or program management, whatever that case is. The point I'm trying to say is we need to invest in creating workers who are going to deal with the challenges of our youth. And I'm being realistic and I'm being practical in here, brothers and sisters. Believe me, we are in emergency situations. You know, subhanAllah, one of the organization, Nasiha, mentioned there's a young person called from Ohio. 40% of the suicide calls come from the state. And they were on a suicide hotline trying to kill themselves. SubhanAllah, look at the condition we're in. Our young people are in dire needs of help. One of the things I want you to think about is becoming a mentor. We have to become mentors. And this was the thing about the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam. He was a mentor for everybody. The fact that he went on his knees and spent time with the young man who lost his bird, 2 hours. It surprises me sometimes that when a young people in your massage is running around and walking, nobody says salam to them, nobody connects with them. Become a mentor for somebody. And when you become a mentor, listen. Remain silent. Just listen. Just talk. Take them out to a coffee. Feed them. Give them, you know, take, just spend few moments and become a mentor just listening. Just listen. You know, they say, listen like a counselor, talk like a politician. Right? And when you inspire them, give them enlightenment, give them opportunity, give them hope. But be a mentor for somebody in the community. If everybody in this room pick one person to mentor, wallahi, that relationship will last forever, I promise you. And this is the thing about our Prophet, subhanAllah. You know, nobody walked in his gathering. The moment he looked at individual in the gathering, Prophet alayhi salam, he knew what the issues they had in their life. He knew all the struggles. And he also knew their capacity. Are they leaders? Are they, you know, would they take responsibilities? And he was able to dedicate that. And this is the beauty of our Prophet alayhi salam. And I believe all of you have the capacity of becoming a mentor. And please help us establish groundwork. Reality is we have to get to work. I'm asking 3 things from you. Number one, make dua. It's free. Okay, make dua for your kids. Make dua for the youth of our community. Number two, get involved. If you don't have a mass chapter in your community, or if you have it, doesn't matter. Get involved. Go to your leadership. Say, how can I help? Can I be a mentor? And number three, financially support. There's nothing happening without money. You have nonprofits like Red Cross, millions of dollars they're spending, and we're afraid to take care of our youth workers. Brothers and sisters, join me please and ask one more last favor. It's an action item. Can you take your Instagram out right now? It's an action item. Please follow us, Mass Youth National, to see all the updates and contents. Jazakum Allah khair. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.